This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is John 8:39 through 41, where it says, "Abraham is our father," they answered. "If you were Abraham's children," Jesus said, "then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you're looking for a way to kill me. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your own father." Now this week, and this is by request, I'd like to take a look at what I call Jesus's anti-sacrifice portrayal of God. And I'll explain what I mean by this later on. But in order to get there, we're going to have to go back as far as we can and look at sacrifice, not religiously, but sociologically. Anthropologists have recognized a repeating pattern throughout human civilizations. Whenever we believe we're competing with one another for a limited amount of resources, as opposed to cooperating with one another where we believe there's enough for everyone, eventually, as we're competing, the unity and cohesiveness of that society begins to pull apart. They're viewed as rivals. Competition and rivalry begin to threaten the health and the longevity of that society. And what anthropologists have also noticed is that, and this can't be explained, is that almost mysteriously but very predictably, a society, when it's beginning to experience this, they will instinctively begin turning on its most vulnerable members and blaming them for the tension or the trouble that the society is beginning to encounter. And this can either be a group or an individual person, but it's whoever the society feels the community would be least diminished by their absence, and something almost magical happens by this. The unity of the society is instantly restored because everyone is now coalescing around a common enemy. The tensions and the trouble that were just previously threatening the cohesiveness of their society, they evaporate into thin air as the society discovers a newfound camaraderie, and previous enemies become friends even, as they all unite around this group or this person that is their new common enemy. And typically this group or this person is expelled from the community either by being sent away or by being more violently lynched via the angry mob. And life for the community then goes on as usual. But before long, the tensions that once plagued the group through their rivalry, those tensions begin to resurface as they continue to compete with one another. And a new sacrifice is required to restore unity again. And the unity that comes through sacrificing a common enemy, anthropologically, it's been seen to be temporary, and it must be continually rekindled. And this is where many anthropologists believe that religion was born as well. Rather than finding another victim to scapegoat, elders within a society sought to recreate and relive the original lynching through ritual rather than repeating the social mechanism again of finding a common enemy in real life. And either another person was used, and that was where a human sacrifice was enacted, or they reenacted the historical event using an animal, and with animal sacrifice. In either case, the story of the original lynching was reenacted, and the community found unity here in coming together to celebrate together their sacred victory over the group or the person that they believed was their common enemy. And it would be well also for all of us to remember that as we're looking at this, that in reality, the original victim was never truly guilty, but innocent. And it was only this victim was only perceived as being guilty by the hysterical or the angry mob. Now, sacrifice in human history, this is how it was born. Religious or ritual sacrifice, whether human or animal, it was an attempt by the community to recreate the original unifying event. And whether a society sacrifices an animal or a human, it wasn't relevant. These societies that sacrifice animals, they would soon sacrifice humans, and eventually they would need to relive the event in real life through finding another enemy for that society to rally together against. So it would escalate from, even if they were just sacrificing animals, it would escalate from an animal sacrifice to a human sacrifice. And then it would leave the area of ritual and have to become actual real life. They'd have to find another enemy that this community could find camaraderie and together being united against. And this is the way of sacrifice. Ritual animals, again, leads to ritual human, which leads to actual human. It's the reversal of this trajectory that the God of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures has always sought to accomplish. And few have noticed this, but God, the God of these narratives, is seeking to reverse this movement. And from the innocence of Abel, who was the nomadic herdsman, and we'll talk about him more in a moment, who was slain by his brother Cain, who was a tiller of the soil, all the way down to Zechariah the prophet, the God of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures has been seeking to cure humanity's need for sacrificing others. Now, let's take a look at Jesus and see how this ties in. Twice in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus uses this phrase, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." That's Matthew 9:13. The second one happens in Matthew 12:7. It says, "But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent." And a point that we must take the time to note is that Jesus in Matthew 12 goes further than in Matthew 9. He goes and says that if we had understood that sacrifice is not of divine origin, but human, we would not have condemned the innocent. Once sacrifice became ritualized, in other words, once it became religious, it was believed that God or the gods actually demanded or required this sacrifice to be done. And this is the picture of God that Jesus tirelessly seeks to refute. And remember, keep in mind that ritual animals led to ritual humans, and that led to actual humans. This is the trajectory that the God we see in Jesus is seeking to heal. Jesus actually saw this in his unique reading of the Old Testament narratives. Jesus came to the conclusion that sacrifice is not of divine origin, but it's human. Jesus teaches that God had never actually required sacrifice, but had always been seeking to lead humanity away from sacrifice to the way of mercy. Notice the following passages, and we'll start with the one that Jesus actually quotes. It's from Hosea 6:6. "I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings." Isaiah 1:11-12 says, "What is it to me, the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings, of rams, and of the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who asked this from your hand?" And note this last question. God is actually implying that the origins of this practice are not to be found in a divine requirement. God's actually asking, who asked you to even do this? Psalms 40:6, David says, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require." In Jeremiah 7:22, Jeremiah says, "For in the day that I brought your ancestors out of the land of Egypt, I did not speak to them or command them concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices." And this passage from Jeremiah, it's the most puzzling of all of them, especially for many scholars, because it contradicts the entire book of Leviticus. Obviously, God did command them concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. So how can Jeremiah's God say that he did not? The answer, I think, I believe, is found in Leviticus 17:7. In Leviticus 17:7, God says, "So that they may no longer offer their sacrifices for goat demons, to whom they prostitute themselves." And just as with patriarchy and misogyny and slavery and racism and violence, the Hebrews were already practicing sacrifice when they came out of Egypt. And the Egyptian sanctuaries too, even the Egyptian sanctuaries had a dual apartment structure of a holy and most holy place. And God is meeting the Hebrews where they are, and subversively from within their own sacrificial practices, leading them away from sacrifice. And remember, the sociological trajectory is ritual animals lead to ritual human, which leads to actual human. Within Leviticus, yes, God is giving instruction regarding sacrifices, but we have to go back and look at those and ask ourselves, is this because there's a desire for sacrifice in the heart of God, or is God making a concession and risking using sacrifice to to try and reverse the trajectory away from actual human, away from ritual human, to ritual animal, and eventually no sacrifice at all. Is God reversing the trajectory? Notice the author of Hebrews, in the author of Hebrews' words about Christ, in Hebrews 10 verse 5, it says, "Therefore, when Christ came into the world, he said, 'Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. With burnt offerings and sin offerings, you were not pleased.'" And some will ask, well, what about Genesis? Didn't God originate sacrifice in Genesis? And I think you'll be hard-pressed to find one single verse in Genesis where God originates and commands sacrifice. It's just not there. It's true that Cain and Abel were making sacrifices, but this only proves that enough time had transpired for humans to have begun practicing sacrifice. Remember, when Cain departs after killing Abel, the earth is by this time well populated. You can find that in Genesis 4:14 and verses 16 through 17. And some will say, but didn't God make clothing for Adam and Eve out of animal skins? And yes, but the type of animals that one uses to produce clothing from their skins, those aren't the animals that are typically used in ritual sacrifices. You wouldn't sacrifice a lamb to get clothing. You would simply shave its wool. In other words, there's no intrinsic connection between ritual sacrifice and the production of clothing. One does not imply the other. And others will ask, well, what about God's acceptance of Abel's sacrifice and God's rejection of Cain's? And I think a lot is lost when we read stories from our own context rather than the context of the original audience. This story was originally told within the context of Mesopotamian landowners that were tillers of the ground and nomadic herdsmen, and the tensions between the two. Those in positions of privilege in this society were the tillers of the ground. They, for agricultural reasons, they looked at land very differently than the nomadic herdsmen. The herdsmen believed that the land belonged to everyone and was not to be privately owned. The herdsmen, being nomadic, were also the weaker of the two groups. And the tillers of the ground, they were more permanent, they were more fortified, and thus more they were stronger. They were the more stable, and they oppressed the migrant nomadic herdsmen as intruders on their property. In the Cain and Abel story, we find God taking the side of the oppressed once again. We see God cursing the ground for Cain's sake and turning Cain from a tiller of the ground to a nomadic wanderer so that he too can learn to view life through the lens of being marginalized and oppressed. And those who claim that Abel's sacrifice was accepted because it contained blood and Cain's didn't, they have to remember that Cain's sacrifice would have been completely acceptable under the Levitical rules for grain, wine, and food offerings, where there was no blood involved either. This is not a matter of blood being present or not, required by a God who required sacrifice. This is the story, it's a story about the way of mercy rather than sacrifice. This is a story containing liberation from oppression, about sacrifice, both ritual and sociological, and about societies being founded on the way of mercy rather than mutual hatred for a common enemy, such as the tillers of the soil who were united against the nomadic herdsmen. And this leads us to our feature text this week. In John 8, 39 through 41, it says, "Abraham is our father," they answered. "If you were Abraham's children," said Jesus, "then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you're looking for a way to kill me. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your own father." And here, Jesus is pulling back the veil. He's showing two trajectories side by side. Number one is the human trajectory. And remember, this is an actual lynching or sacrifice of a common societal enemy is done. B, a ritual sacrifice of animal or human, as an attempt to recreate the unity produced by the original lynching is done. And then C, eventually, the society needs to find a common enemy again. And this is the course of the escalating need for the ritual animal that becomes the need for a ritual human that eventually becomes the need for an actual human enemy for society to unify against. The Abraham trajectory is the exact opposite. It's from ritual human sacrifice back to ritual animal sacrifice. And Jesus came to conclude this trajectory by leading the Hebrew people now away from even ritual animal sacrifice to no sacrifice whatsoever, either ritual or sociological. Jesus's ministry is an anti-sacrifice ministry. It's an anti-sacrifice understanding of God and each other entirely. And if those to whom Jesus was speaking in John 8 would have truly been the children of Abraham, they would have been on a trajectory away from ritual human to ritual animal with the aim of no sacrifice at all eventually. But being children of the accuser in John 8, they were moving in the opposite direction of Abraham. They were moving from ritual animal all the way down their trajectory to a human sacrifice or lynching in the murder of Jesus. Something else we all need to remember as we're looking at this is that there were those in a unique position of privilege that had everything to lose if Jerusalem embraced this revolutionary anti-sacrifice picture of God. And who were they that were privileged, that had so much to lose? It was the priests, especially the chief priest Caiaphas. These were the ones who economically, socially, and politically benefited from ritual sacrifice. In Mark 11:18, it says the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teachings. In John 11:47-50, it says, so the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the council. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and destroy both our holy place and our nation. And remember, the favor of God and thus God's protection of Jerusalem against Rome, they believed, was dependent on the sacrifice continually burning on the altar. You can see this from Josephus in his volume War of the Jews on the ceasing of the daily sacrifices. It's in John 11, it continues, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. You do not understand that it is better for you to have one man die for the people than to have the whole nation destroyed." And here we see it again. Here we see the human sacrificial trajectory of ritual animal leading to ritual human, culminating in an actual human enemy that must be expelled. Those who sacrifice animals, it's not a big leap to start sacrificing humans. And in this case, it was Jesus who is now being killed. And Luke tells us that it was the officers of the temple police who came to arrest Jesus. That's in Luke 22:52. Jesus's interruption of the continual daily sacrifices in the temple would not be tolerated. And it would be good for us to remember that Jesus was not cleansing the temple so that the sacrifices could continue in a pure form. Jesus was overturning tables and driving out the ritual sacrificial animals because God desired mercy, not sacrifice. And this anti-sacrifice element to Jesus's ministry was therefore an anti-temple where the sacrifices were made element, and it was also an anti-priest, the ones who performed the sacrifices in the temple element. And this was not going to be tolerated. This threat had to be extinguished. And as a side note, we have to also recognize the hints in the Jesus story that help us notice what is happening sociologically here. We can't miss these two passages. In Luke 23:12, it says, that day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. And this is the way of sacrifice, sociologically. It's not ritual or religious, it's sociological. Jesus had become not a ritual sacrifice, but an actual sociological one, the enemy around which even rival enemies themselves within a society like Pilate and Herod are now experiencing a newfound unity and friendship as they coalesce against a common enemy. In Mark 15:15, Mark wants us to see it too. It says, wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. And that which drives the sociological sacrifice or a lynching is always the angry mob. It's always to satisfy the mob. It's a mob that gets swept up in the scapegoating mechanism and they just can't help themselves. But also, as we're closing up this week, the story doesn't end in just another lynching by just another human society. On the evening of what John calls the preparation day, it does look as if the world will never change. This is just another occurrence where ritual animal led to ritual human, led to actual sociological human sacrifice. But on the first day of the new week, God would stand in solidarity with Jesus as the lynched victim and inaugurate not just a new week, but a brand new world. God in the resurrection would undo and reverse all that was accomplished through the crucifixion. Paul would later say in Acts 13:32 that we tell you the gospel, that what God promised our ancestors, and remember what the great Hebrew hope was, it was a world where all injustice, oppression, and violence is put right. Paul says he has fulfilled for us their children by raising up Jesus. In the resurrection, a new world has begun. It's a world not founded on the way of sacrifice, but on the way of mercy. This was a new way of arranging human life, a way that Jesus had been modeling for the three previous years. And there's one final point that I'd like to point out before we close. In Matthew 27:51, Matthew tells us that at that moment, the moment that Jesus died, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And I can't end this week without drawing our attention to the contrast here. The priests claimed that God dwelt at the heart of their temple, at the heart of their way of sacrifice. But when Jesus died at the hands of this sacrificial system, the entire way of sacrifice was unmasked as being not of divine origin, but actually being capable of sacrificing or lynching even God too, if God were to be viewed as an intrusive threat as well to society. The resurrection, placed alongside of the torn curtain, it speaks to humanity that God is not at the heart of that system at all. We've mistaken where God actually is. When the temple veil was torn in two, there was no Ark of the Covenant. That had long been lost. There was no Shekinah presence because that had long since departed. What was seen was the stark absence of God. Where was God at that moment? Well, the resurrection reveals that God was actually at the moment of sacrifice in the one being sacrificed. The event marks the end of sacrificial systems that demand the death of those that are innocent. Whether it's a political system that's relying on violence, represented by Pilate, a religious system that's based on fear, represented by Caiaphas, or an economic system driven by greed, represented by Herod, the Jesus story puts on display that the presence of God is not found within the most exclusive holy places belonging to those sacrificial systems. The true dwelling place of the presence is found in the one that's shamefully suspended and sacrificed on a cursed tree at the orders of those sacrificial systems. In other words, all those who are sacrificed by society, God is standing in solidarity with the sacrificed. Heart group application this week. In the book of Revelation, John looks and sees, I saw no temple, and remember the temple's the place of sacrifice, in the city, Revelation 21, verse 22. When heaven and earth become reunited again, there will be no more sacrifice, whether ritual or actual, political, economic, or religious. The resurrection is the start of this whole new world. Just like Jesus, we don't need to fear the consequences of our engagement against the sacrificial systems of our present societies. We stand in the victory of the Christ over all sacrifice, a victory that in all reality has already been won. So number one, this week, I want you to spend some time contemplating with Jesus where you may be still participating in sociological sacrifice, whether in matters of gender, race, whatever it may be. Hardly anyone in the West still practices ritual sacrifice, but we practice sociological sacrifice almost every day. And ask Jesus to show you where you may be doing this as well. Number two, ask Jesus to give you the courage to no longer participate in the injustice, the violence, and the oppression of the way of sacrifice, and to follow the way of mercy instead. Jesus' clearest demonstrations on what the way of mercy actually looks like is found in the entire body of the Jesus stories of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's my belief that these stories are centered on Jesus' radical teachings in Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount. And then number three, whatever Jesus shows you this week, share it with your upcoming heart group. Till the only world that remains is a world where Christ's love and no more sacrifice reigns. Keep living in love. A new world has begun. Let's go and enlarge its radically inclusive borders through humble, servant, nonviolent, co-suffering, injustice-resisting, liberating, non-sacrificial love, one human heart at a time. I love each of you, and remember, God does too. I'll see you next week.